From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A step up in rhetoric after Thursday's exchanges of fire between North and South Korea. We begin with CCTV's Rachel Ruby, who filed this report.
Tensions are rising on the Korean Peninsula after an exchange of fire across the demilitarized zone. And the top leader of the DPRK, Kim Jong-un, has ordered the country's frontline combined forces to enter a state of war from 5 p.m. local time today. Wang Tang-shuan has more.
Tensions are rising across the demilitarized zone, which separates the two neighbors. South Korea's Yonhap News Agency reported DPRK forces shelled South Korean troops on the western border with the DPRK on Thursday. Seoul claimed the shelling targeted loudspeakers that had been blaring anti-Pyongyang broadcast. South Korean responded with scores of shells. The DPRK army said the South fired 36 rounds, six of which landed near its guard posts, in what it called a reckless provocative. The DPRK did not return fire, but it sent a letter warning of military action if Seoul did not stop the broadcast within 48 hours. South Korea's Unification Ministry says Pyongyang sent another letter saying it was willing to resolve the issue, even though it considered the broadcast a declaration of war. On Thursday evening, the Central Military Commission of the DPRK's ruling Workers' Party of Korea convened an emergency enlarged meeting. The country's KCNA news agency reported that at the meeting, Pyongyang denied firing a shell across the border. DPRK leader Kim Jong-un has ordered the frontline combined forces to enter the state of war from 5 p.m. local time Friday. He ordered them to be well-armed to cope with any possible operations at any time. Both countries say there were no casualties or damage in their territory. The two sides last exchanged fire in October when DPRK soldiers approached the military border and did not retreat after South Korea fired warning shots. There were no casualties. Bang Dong-shen, CCTV.
And as Press TV's Kanish Fatima reports, the South is also warned against further provocations, and Seoul is also mobilizing its forces.
South Korean President Park Geun-hye has warned that she will not tolerate any provocation from North Korea. Park made the remarks on a visit to an army headquarters responsible for the western portion of the border with North. Now, the South Korean president has ordered the military to respond immediately if North Korea engages in fresh provocation. Earlier, South Korean Vice Defense Minister said the most likely new North Korean targets would be 11 sites where South Korea operates loudspeakers broadcasting anti-Pyongyang messages. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un has ordered the armed forces to be fully ready for war at any time.
The rising tensions in the region come as the U.S. and South Korea conduct what they call war games. Pyongyang said the games are based on a scenario of invasion and destruction of North Korea, which they consider an act of war. Sarah Flounders is the director of the International Action Center. She pointed out that the history of U.S. aggression against North Korea has particular significance in the current climate.
From the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, people there still so well know 60 years of massive, total U.S. destruction and 60 years of occupation by more than 60,000 U.S. troops still in South Korea. They know from the demilitarized zone one provocation after another and an endless series of war games involving nuclear aircraft carriers, nuclear submarines, nuclear weapons, along with tens of thousands of troops on their border, in their coastal waters, time and again. So from the point of view of North Korea, DPRK, holding on in the face of this, in the face of decades of sanctions and war threats and provocations and a determination to resist that, where sovereignty and national sentiment is fierce, independence is a fierce sentiment, because they have faced down and held on the biggest empire in the world right on their border, and that is U.S. imperialism.
A do-over for elections in Haiti after last week's low turnout disqualified most of the results. The island nation's elections, which had been put off for more than 4 years, failed to attract enough Haitians to the polls for at least 25 of the 119 deputy seats that were up. Another round of voting, to be held October 25th, was announced late Thursday. The announcement that there would have to be reballoting came after a 12-day delay, with the Provisional Electoral Council releasing only a fraction of the tallies of the August 9th vote. The council said that voting must be repeated in 25 of the 119 constituencies due to low turnout. On average, only 18% of the electorate voted, falling short of the 20% needed to qualify. And only 10% voted in the country's most populous department, which includes the capital, Port-au-Prince. According to the Electoral Council, voter turnout did not exceed 50% in any part of the country. Haiti has not had a functioning legislature since January, when Parliament was dissolved after lawmakers' terms had expired, with the elections for their successors having been twice postponed. President Michel Martelly is currently ruling by decree. Resetting elections for October 25th means they will coincide with the presidential elections. The result of the drawn-out election process had been due Tuesday, but by Wednesday only unofficial leaks were circulated. When the Electoral Council finally released some results, they were incomplete and inconclusive. Election officials did not report which of the candidates were elected, and the council's website, which was supposed to display the results, was blank at press time late Friday. Some press reports said only 3 of 119 deputies were successfully elected. Others said 4. The elections for 2/3 of the Senate and the entire lower house, or Chamber of Deputies, were the first carried out under President Michel Martelly, who took office in 2011. Hundreds of thousands of Brazilians took to the streets Thursday in mass demonstrations in support of President Dilma Rousseff. The show of support comes in response to right-wing opposition demonstrations held last Sunday calling for Rousseff's impeachment. Rousseff has accused the opposition of seeking to destabilize the government. And in Ecuador, an opposition leader, Carlos Perez, called on the country's military and police forces to rebel against the government on television. During an interview with Ecuadorian TV channel Tele Amazonas Tuesday, Perez said, quote, "I call on the military, police, you must rebel. You cannot blindly follow an illegitimate act. You cannot do this," closed quote, adding, quote, "If I go to prison for saying this, I welcome this," closed quote. As of Friday, there were no reports of any legal action being taken against the right-wing opposition leader.
With respect to the rights of gays and lesbians, I've been consistent all across Africa on this. I believe in the principle of treating people equally under the law, and that they are deserving of equal protection under the law, and that the state should not discriminate against people based on their sexual orientation.
That was U.S. President Barack Obama last month as he lectured African leaders on the rights of Africa's LGBTQ community, particularly in relation to recent anti-gay legislation initiatives in several African nations.
If you look at the history of countries around the world, when you start treating people differently, not because of any harm they're doing anybody, but because they're different, that's the path whereby freedoms begin to erode. And bad things happen. And when a government gets in the habit of treating people differently, those habits can spread. And as an African American in the United States, I am painfully aware of the history of what happens when people are treated differently under the law. And there's were all sorts of rationalizations that were provided by the power structure for decades in the United States for segregation and Jim Crow and slavery, and they were wrong. So I'm unequivocal on this. If somebody is a law-abiding citizen who is going about their business and working in a job and obeying the traffic signs and doing all the other things that good citizens are supposed to do, and not harming anybody, the idea that they are going to be treated differently or abused because of who they love is wrong. Full stop. And, you know, the state does not need to weigh in on, religious doctrine. The state just has to say, we're going to treat everybody equally under the law. And then everybody else can have their own opinions.
But as many around the world point out, the United States is not exactly in a position to deliver this message from the moral high ground. It's been less than 20 years since then-President Bill Clinton, amid an orgy of gay bashing in the U.S. Congress, signed the so-called Defense of Marriage Act in September of 1996. That law defined marriage for federal purposes as the union of one man and one woman and allowed states to refuse to recognize same-sex marriages granted under the laws of other states. DOMA remained the law of the land until it was finally overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court 2 years ago. It was not long after the bill was passed that the murder of Matthew Shepard, a 21-year-old student at the University of Wyoming, was beaten, tortured, and left to die near Laramie, Wyoming, on October 6, 1998, in an anti-gay hate crime. And if President Obama himself was perceived as standing on the moral high ground as he lectured Africans, it was from ground to which he has only recently himself ascended. When he was a presidential candidate in 2008, California, the state with the most votes in the Electoral College, had on the ballot with him the infamous Proposition 8, which said that, quote, only marriage between a man and a woman is valid or recognized in California, closed quote. When asked about his position on Proposition 8, he said that, although he opposed amending state or federal constitutions to outlaw same-sex marriage, he personally considered marriage to be between a man and woman and supported civil unions that confer comparable rights rather than gay marriage. But Americans in general are also not well poised to lecture Africans in particular on sexual and gender equality. Dr. Anthony Montero is a scholar and an activist. His academic work is focused on Marxism and race. He's the former head and founder of the African Studies program at Temple University. Dr. Montero recently posted an article at his Facebook page entitled 21 Varieties of Traditional African Homosexuality. That piece by Colin Stewart, a veteran journalist, cites a Ugandan academic study documenting at least 21 cultural varieties of same-sex relationships which have long been a part of traditional African life. We discussed that report and the question of sexuality and gender in Africa generally with Dr. Montero via telephone from Philadelphia Friday. So, Dr. Montero, there was a very interesting article that you had posted at Facebook about how various African cultures outside, in Africa have, I don't want to say dealt with homosexuality, the role of homosexuality, I guess, in various African cultures. You want to talk about it a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a summarization of a large body of research in general, and in specific, a report by Ugandan and other researchers who are responding to the anti-homosexual laws in Uganda. And what they're saying is that homosexuality, or in fact, sexuality, period, was not brought to Africa by European colonialists, but that there are long traditions in various parts of Africa of multiple forms of sexuality, sexual identity, and desire. In a lot of ways, it's common sense. And for anyone to think otherwise is verging on the absurd, frankly.
You know, one of the things that's interesting and makes you stop and think, for example, they listed some items that they, you know, were holding out as evidence of this, you know, to prove the case, and effectively, too. And a number of them had to do with people wearing the clothes of the other gender. You know, and you know, it's interesting because, of course, that clothing is not something that we here would identify with one gender or the other because it's not the same style of clothing that we have. So it points out the fact that these are really cultural or, you know, or social constructs rather than things that are strictly sexual.
Yeah, I mean, well first of all, gender and sexuality are culturally historic and historically specific. And it takes a lot of research and ethnography to begin to understand culture's specific approaches to desire, human sexuality, gender, transgendering, gendering back and forth, and so on and so forth. One of the things about Africa that is quite interesting from a research point of view is that most of African history has been a history of decentralized community and political organization, which meant that Africa has a very robust democratic decentralized history, and therefore what people practiced was specific and usually not always embraced by people who were not a part of the specific group. And of course, as with everything in human relationships, things evolve, develop, change, and with something as malleable as sexuality and desire, what is acceptable, what is, we could say, mainstream at a particular time, in a particular place, among a particular ethnic group, in a particular village, might not be the same going forward or going backward. So Africa, I find in my studies of Africa, is perhaps the most complex part of the human universe. And Africans are very, very complex people. Even their approach to language, their multilinguistic capabilities suggest something about their complex approach to human social relationships. There is always this morphing, this developing back and forth. There, you know, we use terms that are that we are comfortable with, such as queer or gay or trans or lesbian or whatever. Those terms might not exist in Africa, in African languages. Most of them didn't exist in European languages before very recently. These are new concepts to reflect new realities. But the fact of the matter is that we can and would be safe to suggest that Africa's approach to human sexuality was as complex as its approach to everything else in the social and human universe.
And you would think, with it being so decentralized, that, you know, and we're talking about now, you know, with 6.5 billion people in the world, there's a billion people in Africa. So holding some relative, you know, consistency as a percentage of population, we're talking like a sixth of humanity being there. Some of the oldest civilizations in the world, the mother of, you know, of all humanity, actually. And with it decentralized and spread like that, you're talking about essentially looking at, in an unrestricted way across the continent, the full spectrum of human sexual behavior.
That's my point, as well as human gender behavior. and as well as humanity's experimentation with these issues. All you have to do is go to Africa and you see human populations that are so adept at dealing with human difference and human complexity, more so than we in the West are, because the West, as we know it today, what we call the West, what we call the modern world, is predicated upon worldviews that are hierarchical, one would suggest dogmatic, static, and singular. All of that is very different from what we see in Africa. Africa is more flexible, improvisational, is more prone to democracy from the grassroots, and Africans, the African mind over history has developed in such ways to accept complexity and contradiction as givens. So we're dealing with two very different civilizational and historical developments.
Europe, for example, had for almost 2,000 years since the creation of the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. Uniform rules, laws, uniform treatment of reproduction, the conditions under which it could be done, very limited, sexual behavior, gender identity, all of those things were very rigid up until the past few years. And then, as Europeans came into contact with Africans, they attempted to impose those same behaviors.
Absolutely.
And then, and generally at the point of a gun or a sword. And then you have, here in the United States, which only a few years ago is the place where Matthew Shepard was murdered, going to Africa and lecturing Africans there about tolerance towards homosexuality. How does that look to people through, the people in Africa, through their own eyes, with their own experience?
Well, I think it's obvious. Africans look at the white West as hypocritical, claiming everything, but violating those claims regularly. But I'm very influenced by the work of Frederick Engels on the origin of the family, private property, and the state, because I think he finds the correct connection between misogyny, patriarchy, private property, and the state. Now, one of the things that we know about most of Africa for most of its history is that private property relations were very, very weak if they existed at all. The cooperative, collective, and communal form or socialistic form of property ownership and property relationships have dominated throughout most of African history. Hence, one can assume, and I think this is not a strange assumption, that where there are weak relationships of private property ownership, that most of the evil and social oppression which comes with the defense of private property would not exist in its absence. So when we talk about misogyny, patriarchy, the state and the so-called law-based organization of human relationships, one would find more space for human difference, for human experimentation, for human desire, for modes of gender relationships other than the patriarchal and misogynist form in Africa than we have ever seen in the West. We make a big deal of the law-based transformation of gender and sexual relationships. And these are important from the standpoint of the West. But that's because the law had violated and trumped the human spirit. In Africa, I would suggest the human spirit was never as imprisoned and trumped like it has been over the history of the West, especially since the rise of the Catholic Church and certainly the rise of private property, and especially the rise of private property under capitalism.
You know, that raises another interesting question, particularly over the timing. In China, even if you term China as being capitalist now, with a population, a good portion of which went through the Cultural Revolution, however, China is competing, quote-unquote, with the U.S. and Europe in Africa, both strategically and in terms of peripheral economic issues as well. Is it possible, do you think, that there's some kind of a connection between the West attempting to emphasize issues around gender and sexuality at a time when China could be emphasizing economic relations?
I think that's a very interesting observation. Certainly, this whole preoccupation with homophobia and homophobic laws, especially in places like Uganda, which, by the way, has a long history, documented history by anthropologists of multiple sexualities and multiple sexual practices. But what we see is, just like they used the question of gay marriage and homosexuality as a wedge issue in American politics, it seems that they're trying to use it in the same way as a wedge issue in Africa, but a wedge issue which elevates and consolidates the power of those neo-colonialist misleaders in Africa that are pro-American, because this is an American project in Africa.
Yeah, I'm thinking in terms of you know, them saying basically, we don't care who you sleep with as long as your money comes to us.
and the other side of, I think, the Chinese position is that what you do, your society is your society. We respect your rights. And I think the Chinese position is more a position of what we would call the coexistence of different cultural and social systems.
Right. Okay.
What the United States position is that of hegemony. And the United States, be it Africa or any place else in the world, does not accept the idea of peaceful coexistence between different cultural values, different social systems, different economic systems.
And what about here in the United States? You know, my anecdotal experience that most of the black kids that I grew up with had fairly religious parents or grandparents and were encouraged to go to church, they seemed much more tolerant towards homosexuality than the white parents were. Is that a pretty general experience in the black community in the U.S., do you think? And if so, could it be related to the African cultural history?
Well, I think to the first question, I would agree with you. And I think researchers are finding this to be the case, that homophobia is not organic to black sexual cultural practices. And there was generally a greater generosity and tolerance of homosexuality in black religious institutions than in white religious institutions. Now, with the post-civil rights rise of evangelical Christianity and the prosperity gospel, you have the appearance of a hardcore homophobia.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.